From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. Raychel grew up to become an actor starring in big-name musicals, but the people he left behind in Brooklyn didn't have such luck. When he went back, he found his friends' lives had veered off course into drug addiction. On today's Fresh Air, Raychel tells us how going home again proved inspiration for his first novel, Iced. Also, we'll talk with Jane Hamilton about putting the unthinkable into words in A Map of the World. Her new book is about a child who drowns and a woman whose life changes forever as a result. And world music critic Milo Miles has a review of a new CD set featuring the late blues artist Robert Pete Williams. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Israel and Jordan have opened a border crossing between their two nations. It's the latest step toward a full peace treaty. At today's ceremony, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said the walls of hostility are tumbling down. Jordan's Crown Prince Hassan said the opening represents his country's commitment to peace. He spoke to the crowd in Hebrew today, saying the opening is a gate of hope. Wildfires continue to burn forest and rangeland in 8 western states. 21,000 firefighters are trying to control 40 major blazes. National Guard troops will join fire crews in Utah this week because of a shortage of firefighters there. From Salt Lake City, NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Utah Governor Mike Leavitt declared a state of emergency so he can use National Guard soldiers for firefighting. Fire managers here say they can't get the crews or helicopters they need to fight 7 major blazes burning more than 35,000 acres. Air tankers did arrive when needed this weekend to protect 2 small towns. About 100 National Guard troops begin fire training today. Resources are stretched thin nationwide due to 52,000 fires this year, scorching more than 2 million acres. Utah is experiencing one of its hottest and driest summers ever. 24 new blazes ignited since yesterday. Flames threaten a stand of bristlecone pines, trees that are thousands of years old and are considered the oldest living things on Earth. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
Justice Department officials are recommending that an independent prosecutor investigate Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy's ties to the nation's largest poultry producer, Tyson Foods. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The Justice Department has been investigating Secretary Espy over gifts of travel, lodging, and football tickets he received from Don Tyson, the head of the nation's largest chicken producer and a political ally of the president. Espy has said he fully reimbursed Tyson and denied any connection between those gifts and delays in poultry inspection rules. A Justice Department official who asked not to be identified said earlier this year officials decided as a matter of principle to wait for the independent counsel law to take effect and see if one was justified in the Espy case. White House counsel Lloyd Cutler said yesterday the decision to ask for an independent counsel is entirely Janet Reno's. She's expected to act in the next several days. I'm Peter Kenyon in Washington.
The International Red Cross says the Bosnian Serbs confirm they are sending Bosnian Muslim men to forced labor camps. A Red Cross spokeswoman says it has a list of 111 men who have been so detained. It's the first proof that large numbers of Muslim men have been incarcerated in a northwest Bosnian camp over the past few weeks. The agency says the men were sent to the camp as part of a new ethnic sweep by Bosnian Serbs. About 300 Muslim women, children, and elderly people were forced from their homes. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up almost 6 points at 3,752. This is NPR. Many Wall Street analysts believe that telephone companies will pick up most of the tab for building the information superhighway. They say that regional phone companies will issue bonds to handle the estimated $100 billion cost. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
Analyst Arthur Gruen of Wilkowski and Gruen Associates says telephone companies will be the main spenders on the information superhighway, not only because of their deep pockets, but because of their access to technology. Gruen says the companies will use debt capital as opposed to their own money because he adds they're not going to want to deplete their cash holdings by large amounts on a very risky thing. The companies are expected to issue bonds to handle the cost, and for Wall Street, that move could mean $40 to $100 billion in new business in the next 2 decades. Some analysts doubt there will be a huge increase in bond issuance. A Moody's Investors Service analyst says the phone companies generate healthy cash flows, so they have the capability to fund a lot of capital spending out of externally generated sources. One of the biggest stumbling blocks to the new information network is working out how much of the cost the telephone companies can pass along to their customers. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The Associated Press is quoting White House staffers who say the new Whitewater Independent Council may be biased against President Clinton. Kenneth Starr, the new counsel, is a Republican who served in the Bush administration. He's recently criticized the president's lawyers for seeking presidential immunity in a sexual harassment suit filed against Mr. Clinton. The president's lawyer, Robert Bennett, told the Washington Post today Starr should decline the appointment. Bennett says there's a real appearance of unfairness. Tipper Gore, Vice President Al Gore's wife, is in Rwanda helping relief efforts. She spent nearly 5 hours today in the biggest refugee camp in Goma, Zaire. Mrs. Gore says conditions are still dire, but there is improvement. She says her visit is a personal one, and she does not plan to draft a report when she returns to Washington. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Rachel was raised in a housing project in Brooklyn and now lives and works as an actor in London. The touring company of a gospel musical got him to London more than 10 years ago. He stayed on to appear in such productions as Miss Saigon, Jesus Christ Superstar, and Starlight Express. Back in the States in 1991, while on tour for a Lloyd Webber show, he got the idea for his first novel, Iced. While catching up with old friends from the neighborhood, he kept hearing the same story over and over again. Some of the best and brightest had become crack addicts. He was shocked. So Shell set about interviewing crack users around the country to find out why young men who had so much promise became 40-something addicts. Iced is written in the first person. It's the diary of a 44-year-old crack addict, Cornelius Washington Jr., as he reflects on his life. Rachel told me that although Cornelius is a composite character, he drew most on his old neighborhood buddy, who seemed most likely to succeed, but didn't.
You know, you always have one person in your neighborhood, your mom says, why can't you be like him? And he was the one that my mother used to always say, why can't you be like him? And I always thought that this guy was going to do, and he was the first in our neighborhood to go to college. He was the first to get a job outside of the neighborhood, because I lived in Brooklyn. He was in Manhattan. He was going to Columbia. This guy had it all. He was good looking. He was tall. He had all the girls, you know, things that I wanted. And then to see him now, at age 45, 47, it was just heartbreaking. I felt like somebody had died, and that freaked me out again because I thought crack addicts were people like 15, 17, 18. And I found out that these were the kids who were selling it. And then it made more sense that I was wondering why the young black people here were so busy gangbanging and killing each other, but the people that they should be looking up to for support and direction, their fathers and their uncles and their big brothers, were involved in this drug, which made more sense. That part of it made sense to me.
When you talked to your friend, did you ask him what had happened to him, this person that had so much promise in your neighborhood?
Well, yes, I did, and it was hard having a conversation with him because he had moments of lucidity, and there were other moments where he was just going to flights of fancy. He would ask me, he had been in the army, and he asked me, was my brother all right? Had they done anything to his brain? So I say, well, as far as I know, he's all right. I didn't, and he kept talking about these people that would come in the night and take things away from him. And that's where I got the whole idea of the ghost people, because he would never admit to that he would never admit anything. He wouldn't admit that he had a problem. He wouldn't admit that there was something wrong. There were other people who did this to him. There were people that gave him the drug through certain means. He would never say that he went out and got it. So that's where I sort of got the whole idea about these ghost people and these people that sort of did things to people, to Cornelius, which in effect was that he was just denying the whole thing. It was just denial.
Well, the book you've written called Iced is written in the first person, written by someone you call Cornelius Washington Jr. He's addicted to crack. He's in his mid-40s, and the book is a kind of a diary. I'd like to have you read, actually, from the very beginning of the book to give us a feel for who this guy Cornelius is.
I'd love to. My sister lives down Brooklyn with her husband, the sucker who don't like me. I used to go down to her place and see her. I would jump the subway money thing and catch the train and go down and see her and get some money for the pipe man and see her. But she told me that her husband didn't want me coming around here. She would cry every time she saw me, cry all the time, like a woman. She would take my hand into hers and call me Junior. Junior, like she was trying to wake me up or something, and she tried to feed me. I was never hungry, not for chicken and rice. Lorraine, yeah, that's her name. She pays the rent on this place. She must pay it. she or my mama, because I don't pay it, and the ghost people ain't coming around to throw me out like they done to some of the other people that used to live around here. You must understand something first. It wasn't always like this. Things used to be up, so up. It's hard for me to tell you how up specifics escape me. I see snapshot memories. My memories used to run across my mind like the movies, like a good fast movie like The French Connection. A whole block of memories got smudged or erased when the pipe time came. I don't know how it happened. Memories that used to hip-hop like angry roaches across my brain movie style slowed down to comic strip frames in a funny paper like peanuts. Now my memories come in snapshots one at a time. I really gotta concentrate to focus them in. Sometimes I feel like I'll just white out. There won't be no picture in my mind of anything. It'll just be white and black interference signals, like when the last picture of TV goes off.
That's Ray Schell reading from his novel called Iced. Well, in your novel, Cornelius is 16. He's accepted by Columbia University. This is part of his memories as he looks at his life. He wants to be a lawyer. He's his parents' pride and joy. He's got everything all set and going for him. Did you find that this was pretty true with a lot of the men that you talked to, is that they did have a number of things going for them?
Well, yes. I mean, I'd say one of the things I didn't say the last time about the similarities, this was the first time for most of us just being free. I wouldn't say we came from very, very, how can I say, stern backgrounds. My father was a Pentecostal minister, and most of the kids I was at school with, their parents were aspiring to be middle class. And we had two parents in the home, a mother and a father, and they expected things of us. They had very high expectations for us. Our lives were monitored. We were watched very, very closely in terms of what we did outside of the home. So to get into a situation like Boston, where there's all these students from all over the place, nobody telling you what time to go to bed, nobody telling you even to brush your teeth or anything, all this freedom, that was the first time in our lives that we had all this freedom just to do what we liked. And a lot of this freedom killed us.
Well, did you feel then like your parents were, and I understand, was your mother a Pentecostal minister too?
Both of them. They still are.
Okay. I mean, did they watch, monitor your every move?
Well, I had a balance. There was some things my mother would let me do that my father wouldn't, and then some things my father would let me do my mother wouldn't. My mother didn't want me to go to school to be an actor, but my father was. He was my first director, so he encouraged it. My mother met my father because he was a Sunday school teacher. He's my stepfather, and he was my Sunday school teacher, so every time they had like a Father's Day or Christmas pageant, I had to be in it. So he was my first director, so he was thrilled when I got accepted into acting school, but my mother wanted me to be something like a doctor. My mother also didn't mind me going outside of the neighborhood and working and just seeing what the world was like. He probably would have preferred me to be a little bit closer to home, but he understood it. So I was able to have a balance. I've been like flying around the world since I was 15 years old. So I tend to think they prepared me for what I'm doing now. That's why my son is with me here as well, so you can actually see the life that I came from. So I was very blessed in that my parents were strict, but at the same time, they were very, very liberal in terms of letting me get out in the world and see that there was a world outside of Lewis H. Pink houses.
Do you think that explains why you're okay, at least in terms of you didn't smoke crack and have been able to kind of follow this dream of yours to be an actor?
Well, I think, honestly speaking, I think the thing that saved my life was going to England, because I say if I had been in London, I mean, if I had been in Boston along with my friends and had been around my friends, like I said, you don't expect your friends to kill you or hurt you. And again, we like to get high. Getting high to us was a way of keeping one foot in the ghetto, if you understand what I mean. We'd go home from school and, oh, here comes the college boys. They think they know everything. Here's something new. Have you tried this? So to be down with our friends, to be down with our peers, getting high was a way of saying, okay, I'm going to college, but I'm down with you, and I'm going to do this with you. I could have been very easily a Cornelius myself because at that time, like I said, when the price went up, nobody did it. The whole thing was cocaine. And from after cocaine, it was crack. So I don't have any illusions about saying that I was stronger or better or anything like that. I tend to think I was in England. It wasn't there. I was involved with Lloyd Webber. and that was very, very lucky. The musical whole shift, the musical theater shifted over to England for some weird reason. So I just happened to be there when things like Starlight Express happened, which I was part of the original company, and Miss Saigon and Five Games. I was Five Guys named Mo, not Five Gays named Mo. Five Guys named Mo. I was just very lucky and blessed to have been in England at that time. But had I been here, there's no telling what would have happened.
Well, let me have you read another section from the book. And again, this is the book is called Iced, and it's a kind of a diary kept by a man named Cornelius Washington Jr. He's in his mid-40s, and he's addicted to crack, and it's written by our guest today on Fresh Air, Ray Schell.
I couldn't sleep. Sleep deprivation sucks. I started hallucinating after working 5 days in a row and not sleeping at night, smoking all night. Big time hallucinations. I would be ladling chicken noodle soup into a bowl, and the noodles would turn into 40 skinny white Diana Rosses, snake dancing out of the ladle, shimmering into the soup bowl, screeching, "Stop in the name of love," loudly. Of course I dropped the ladle in the bowl, howling with terrified mirth. A white Jewish lady with blue-gray hair sat down in one of my booths. She was wearing one of those blue-gray fox wraps that have fox or chinchilla heads with teeth on one end and claws and feet at the other end. This lady must have gave me her wrap and asked me to hang it up. I know that she must have handed it to me, but it seemed to me that the blue-gray beady-eyed fox thing jumped out of her hand, snarling and barking at me. I wrestled the chinchilla fox thingy to the floor, screaming like a deranged Cherokee, trying my level best to stomp the beady-eyed teeth-bearing thing to death. The blue-gray Jewish lady was mortified. She sued. Of course I was fired. That was back in the mid-80s, I think. It had to be around that time because that was a time when I was doing all those weird jobs. Money to live, I told myself. I didn't acknowledge my addiction. Piping was a pastime for me. I hadn't taken it up as a full-time occupation. I wasn't in love. I wasn't infatuated. I was having an affair. We hadn't gotten married.
That section you just read is both funny and so tragic at the same time because, of course, this Cornelius is his losing it. I mean, he's not his grip on reality is disappearing. But on the other hand, you could almost take this as a comedic scene.
Yeah. Well, I felt that I didn't want to have something that people would want to slit their wrists to. And I felt that I had to balance it with some funny elements. I mean, after talking with the guys, I found out that there were just some horrific things that had happened to them. And so horrific that I didn't think anybody would believe it. So just talking to the people just gave me a circle of events that, an arena or a boundary of events that what was possible under the drug and what was possible was almost anything as long as there was a reason to get to that.
Well, certainly you've spent many years as an actor and this is your first novel. Did you feel that you had to become Cornelius to be able to write about him?
Well, that's what I had to do. I mean, it was sometimes it was really funny because I'd be writing backstage between acts, and the first act, and the first song in the second act was Evita. And I'd be taking Cornelius on stage singing, Evita, Evita, baring my teeth. My kids were saying, Ray, what is wrong with you? And I would laugh because I'd forget that I was still in character. And, you know, I would be running around and you know, in the hotel room while they'd be out partying and stuff, just my little diary, just scribbling things away. And they'd say, we saw you talking to some weird people last night. Maybe you should be careful about this. And then when I explained to them what I was doing, they're saying, wow, that's interesting. So now, 2 years later, seeing the book in the shops and everything, the cast remembers what I was going through then. So I tend to think I have Andrew Lloyd Webber to thank for this book, quite frankly.
Well, my guest today on Fresh Air is Ray Schell. He is an actor and a singer and now a novelist. He's just written his first novel. It's called Iced. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Ray Schell is our guest today, and he is an actor, lives in England, and has just published his first novel, and it's called Iced.
Let me ask you a little bit about growing up in Brooklyn, and you said that both your parents were Pentecostal ministers. How often would you go to church in a week?
All the time.
Every day?
Not every day. It started, let's say, on Friday nights. We had Friday night service. Saturday was like choir rehearsal and prayer. We had tarrying service on Saturday nights because tarrying was like getting the Holy Ghost. You had to stay and tarry and wait for the Holy Spirit to become part of your life. Sunday was all-day affair. We might be able to have to go to church on Wednesday night for Bible study. So it might be, it was definitely Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. If there was a service, a special service, and we were in a choir and we were expected to sing, it might be Tuesday and Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Well, did you ever want to go out and play baseball with your friends?
Yes, of course I did. It was fine up until I was about 13 and 14 when I discovered girls, and then just found out that there were friends of mine who were doing other things on the weekends, like sneaking off to clubs and stuff like that. And then when I started working in May's department store at about 16, I would create reasons why I couldn't go to church that night. I had to work late, or I had to, a friend of mine wanted me to help me with his homework, or we had to study for SATs, and then I would sneak off to, let's say, the Bonsoir and see Barbra Streisand, or I would get my high school had these tickets whereby you could get to see a Broadway show. And that's how I fell in love with Broadway. They would give us these tickets that if a show wasn't selling out, we could go and watch it. And I think the first thing I saw was Lee Remick's Wait Until Dark at the Music Box Theater. So my mother, when she found out that that's the kind of things I was doing, and I wasn't really hanging out in the street and getting in trouble, she didn't mind me spending less time at church. I remember on our prom night, I ran out of money, so here is me going up to my father's church with this big white limousine, and my father was in the middle of a prayer line praying for everybody, and I had to stand in the prayer line about five people in front of me. And then when I got up to him and he was about to anoint me, I said, "Daddy, I need some money." So
did he give it to you?
He prayed for me, and then he gave me the money and came outside and met my friends. But it was like the most, and they were sitting in the car saying, "Well, what is he doing in there?" And I had to stand in the prayer line and get my anointing and then get the money and then leave.
Well, now, you said it was having these tickets to Broadway that kind of, I guess, got you the acting bug.
Yeah.
What was it about, I guess, seeing some of these big plays on Broadway that appealed to you so much?
Well, I'd never seen, you're sitting in an audience, the lights goes down, a curtain raises, and you're in a different world. I mean, I had never been backstage, so I didn't know that behind this scenery were, I don't know, sandbags, and it was just painted scenery. They all looked so lifelike and so real, and the people on stage were so comfortable, and as if we weren't there, it felt like I was eavesdropping on somebody else's life. And then to find out that people actually got paid to do that, and they had to do it 8 times a week, it was just intriguing. It was a world I had never seen before. So that I wanted to be a part of that, and it echoed back to my little Sunday school pageants. But to actually find this big, beautiful building with all these people, glamorous people, you know, with minks and everything, sitting in the audience, watching these people on stage, I wanted to do that. That's what I wanted to do.
How did you get over to England?
Well, I'm in the book. I wrote myself in his Skeets, the guy that couldn't string two sentences together. And I was sitting, it happened that way. I was sitting at the Hotel Operatic, which is a condominium now, and I was reading backstage, and I had a few people, friends over, and it said I needed an actor to a show that would have a national tour and then would go on to London. So I just left and said, look, I got to go to this audition. And I got there. If I had been like 5 minutes late, I wouldn't be sitting here now, because they were about to go to Philadelphia to start the auditions. And I couldn't go because I didn't have the money. I said, look, you got to audition me here. And they did, and they gave me the part. We toured America for a year, and the show got to England.
What was the play? What was the show?
It was called Little Willie Jr.'s Resurrection. We had our premiere at the Walnut Street Theater. And after getting to England, we didn't know that Little Willie was a euphemism for a male's anatomy. And I was Little Willie, and my father was Big Willie. And we'd have all these men in raincoats in their laps during the first act. And then the second act, they'd all be gone. And we were at the same theater that Let My People Come was at. So we didn't find, we didn't, we, they thought it was a sex show. So,
but you didn't.
We didn't
you
know.
Had no idea.
We hadn't. And then when it was a gospel musical. And when they were sitting there looking perplexed during the entire first act, I guess they were waiting for us to take our clothes off or something. And when we didn't, they left after that. So we didn't last very long.
I know that you've performed in a number of Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals. What did his work offer you as both a singer and an actor?
Well, he gave me an opportunity. I was a totally unknown to him. I was teaching acting and voice at this time. I had given up all hopes of really being in theater because I didn't see it happening over there. I was an American actor, and I didn't have a British accent at the time. I can actually do one now if I have to. But, I mean, I didn't have one then. So when I auditioned, I was teaching acting and voice, and one of my students had went to audition, and he didn't get it. And he said, well, Mr. Shell, you're always telling us to try things. Why don't you go and try? And I said, well, I'm not very young, and I hadn't roller skated in 20 years, but I will go to this audition, but I won't tell my students, because if I don't get it, they're not going to want anybody to teach them who can't get a job himself. And I remember I went down to two auditions, and in the second audition, Trevor Nunn and Andrew Lloyd Webber got up and put their arms around me, and they offered me the lead. And it was the changing of my whole career, my whole life.
And that was Starlight Express,
that was Starlight
if you're talking
Express.
About roller skates, right?
Yeah, and I played the lead role. I played Rusty. In fact, it's weird because people here in this country have probably heard me on record and didn't even know it was me because I didn't get to do the Broadway production. I was doing Jesus Christ Superstar. And the London production of Starlight Express is still running in London because it was a very different production from the one that was done on Broadway. But the Broadway production only lasted less than a year. I tend to think if they had brought me over and kept the production the way it was in London, it probably would still be running. But the economics of American theater are very different, so they're able to take a lot more chances than they are here.
Reading through your novel, Iced, I got the feeling that this could be turned very easily into a performance piece. Have you thought about that? Have you done it?
Well, we have done it. I've just done two 25-minute pieces in Atlanta, and I performed it at PS 122 earlier in June. And we have a British producer, William Butler Slough, who wants me to develop it into a full evening's theater, which is what I want to do. I've got to do the second novel. I'm working on the second novel now. And we've also had film option offers from Bill Duke and a man called, I can't remember his name. I should know his name, but so much has happened since this has started. So there are offshoots that are happening. And I'm still trying to be very cool about it all. But I keep feeling like I want to jump up and down and go, yay!
When you performed this for PS 122, was that a high school?
No, it's a performance space in on the east side in New York.
Okay.
It used to be a school. It was a school, and they've taken it and made it into a performance space, an amazing place. It was really, really interesting. I felt like I was going back to school, and it was just unusual that it's like a more funkier kind of public theater. New York Public Theater, Joseph Papp's old place.
Sure.
And it's a smaller performance space, but you're able to develop things without the pressure of commercial eyes. And once you have a piece ready to be seen by reviewers, and then that's when they bring them in.
What was the audience reaction like?
Shocked.
Shocked, yeah.
Even my sisters had never seen me say some of those things. They'd never seen me do any some of those things. They were shocked. But I said, well, that's part of what's written into it. I like to just shock people into realizing that the people that they pass in the streets have lives, were people, used to be somebody, have dreams and ambitions. And I tend to think that sometimes America, we can get so used to hopelessness. We get so used to seeing the bad things. There's so much bad news about that we forget that the people involved suffer. It's the news of what's happened to the person becomes more important than the people themselves. And so, if anything, I just hope people can actually look at ICE and remember that these people do have lives and hopes and dreams.
Ray Shell is an actor. Her first novel is called Iced. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Coming up, the course of a life can be altered in a moment. We talk with novelist Jane Hamilton about how an instant of inattention leads to the death of a child and changes two families forever. It's the subject of her new novel, A Map of the World. And world music commentator Milo Miles has a review of a new CD set featuring the recordings of little-known blues guitarist Robert Pete Williams. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton is meeting with more than a dozen law enforcement leaders today. He's enlisting their help in lobbying House members who are struggling to bring the crime bill to the floor. The law enforcement leaders say the gun ban is a non-negotiable issue. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Cornelius Behan, retired Baltimore County Police Chief and legislative chairman of the Major City Police Chiefs Association, emerged from a crime bill strategy session with President Clinton to say the assault weapons ban stays in the bill no matter what.
And if we walk away from that effort, we'll be not doing what we're supposed to do as chiefs of police.
With the president's prodding, law enforcement officials are pointing fingers at the powerful National Rifle Association for stalling the $30 billion bill on a procedural vote in Congress. Over the weekend, Mr. Clinton challenged the NRA to come out of the shadows and fight the bill in the open. Carol Van Dam, The White House.
United Nations relief workers say they're afraid a new tide of Rwandan refugees will wash into Zaire soon. They say it could happen later this month when French troops are scheduled to leave the region. A spokesman for the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees says a million people could cross the border. French officials say they're thinking about staying on until mid-September to keep the peace. The UN wants them to stay even longer. North Korea and the United States have resumed talks in Geneva aimed at resolving the dispute over the North's nuclear program. Not much progress is reported. The BBC's Gordon Martin has more from Geneva.
Neither of the negotiators had any comment as they entered the lakeside villa housing North Korea's diplomatic mission, and it's unlikely there'll be any early breakthroughs. The first priority for U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Robert Gallucci is to persuade the North Koreans to allow full inspection of their nuclear program. It was Pyongyang's refusal to do this that set off the whole crisis 3 months ago, since it increased fears that North Korea was building nuclear weapons. In return for compliance, North Korea stands to gain economic aid and diplomatic recognition. Washington is keen to help equip North Korea with more modern reactors of a type less capable of producing plutonium for nuclear warheads.
Gordon Martin reporting. The Bosnian Serbs have announced just how much land they want out of a peace deal. The Speaker of the Bosnian Parliament says his people must be given 64% of Bosnia before they'll accept any peace deal. The Serbs now hold about 70% of the former Yugoslav Republic, much of it by conquest. An international peace plan would require them to take about 49%. The Serbian leader says that plan would leave the Bosnian Serbs with only about 20% of the country. The new demand isn't expected to win any support. Stock prices closed with a small gain today. The Dow added 7 points to close at 3,753. Advances led declines by a slight margin. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Anti-abortion activists are staging demonstrations this week at the only two abortion clinics in Mississippi. Organizers are demanding written peace agreements from all participants, but one of the organizers has signed a justifiable homicide paper. That document supports the murder of doctors who perform abortions, but Joseph Foreman of the American Coalition of Life Activists says he will be nonviolent. Abortion rights activists are not convinced. They plan to make sure women who want access to the clinics are safe. Today is the final deadline for food companies to get the government's new food label on their packages. This order applies to all packaged foods regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports. The FDA's original deadline for companies to get the new label on their products was 3 months ago. But several thousand firms complained that would leave them with stockpiles of useless bags and boxes carrying the old label, so Congress extended the deadline to August 8th. As of today, nearly all packaged foods must carry the new panel called Nutrition Facts. Consumers might see a few old labels for several more months as products that were in storage hit the shelves. Shoppers might also spot the old label on ground beef. That's because another agency, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, regulates meat, and USDA is caught up in a dispute over how to define the term percent lean for ground beef labels. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
The New Hampshire Fish and Game Department has opened an investigation of the Schiller Power Plant. Up to 200 lobsters are being sucked into the plant's cooling system every day. Some are smashed by the machinery, but many go home as dinner with the employees. Fish and Game officials found 28 live lobsters on a worker who was leaving the plant recently. They searched his home and found 508 more, most of which were frozen. The Public Service Department is now redesigning the Schiller plant's intake pipes as a result. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. Howard and Alice Goodwin are transplants from the urban East Coast and have moved to Wisconsin to work a dairy farm and to find an easier, more secure life for themselves and their family. About halfway through Jane Hamilton's novel about the Goodwins, A Map of the World, Howard muses, "It's difficult to pinpoint exactly when our lives began to unravel. Was it the drowning of a neighbor's child who was visiting the Goodwins? Was it his wife's arrest for alleged child abuse?" A Map of the World is a searing account of guilt and forgiveness and an unflinching picture of small-town life. Reviewing A Map of the World for Newsweek magazine, Laura Shapiro wrote, "There's nothing garish or manipulative about Hamilton's approach to these events. She's exploring them, not exploiting them. Her tone is beautifully controlled, her style calm and lucid." Jane Hamilton lives in Wisconsin, also a transplant from the East, where she and her husband are apple farmers. This is Jane Hamilton's second novel. Her first, The Book of Ruth, won the Penn Hemingway Foundation Award in 1989. Let's begin with a reading from A Map of the World.
The first part is narrated by Alice Goodwin, who's trying to be the farm wife, and she's babysitting at the beginning for her neighbor's children, and she realizes fairly early on, after they've arrived, that one of the littlest girl, Lizzie, is missing, and she's running around looking for the child. Lizzie's 2 years old, and she all of a sudden realizes that the kitchen door is wide open and that possibly the little girl has wandered off towards the pond. And so she heads out. She says, "Do not leave this house," I ordered, talking to her other children. And then I was out the door and across the garden, down the wooded lane to the pond. I suspect that when animals, a deer or a fox, run from their predators, they are governed by a keen intelligence. They do not waste their movements. And because they know the depth of the woods, the breadth of a field, they flee anticipating the curve of the land, the perfectly situated thicket. I ran like a blind person, stumbling over my own heavy limbs. When I came to the clearing, I couldn't see past the single glaring point of sunlight dancing on the water. I put my hand to my forehead to make a visor, and still it took me a minute to find the pink seersucker bottom just beneath the surface, about 15 feet from the beach. When I am forced to see those 10 minutes as they actually were, when I look clearly without the scrim of half-uttered prayers and fanciful endings, I am there, tall and gangly and clumsy and slow, crying out unintelligibly, splashing through the water to Lizzie. I had nothing of a hero's elegance or pace. As I moved, I was thinking, she's fine, she's fine. People don't really drown in shallow places. That's an old wives' tale. She's probably looking for minnows or stones or snails so far from the shore. I pulled her up and slung her over my shoulder, tripping through the water, screaming then, screaming for help. I didn't know how to make enough noise to be heard. I was shrieking with so much force I felt as if I might split, and yet all the world was placid, still. The leaves in the trees hung limp like palsied hands. I lay Lizzie on her back, that was right, and then I tilted her chin and put my ear to her cold chest and tried to listen. It was impossible to hear anything but the noise of myself panting and dripping, and the bamming of my own sturdy heart. Lizzie's skin was rubbery, her face the gray of an old carp, her lips dark as blueberries. Her wide, unblinking eyes were the color of mud. I opened my mouth and screeched again. I'm sure I felt for her pulse before I tore her jumpsuit and began pumping wildly on her chest.
That's Jane Hamilton reading from her new book called A Map of the World. I have to tell you, this is a very hard book to read. The things that happen in this book are things I don't even want to think about. But what is it to write about it? Because I would think as a writer, you have to live. I mean, almost listening to you read that passage, you have to live this stuff, don't you?
I think I wrote it because I wanted, as a parent, I feel that every next step is the disaster and waiting to happen. And it's just by whatever luck or some would say grace that, you know, you escape and have good fortune. And I feel, I think maybe just the opposite of you. I feel that if I look at something, if I really look at it, then it won't happen. And I think that, you know, part of the pleasure of writing is stepping into somebody else's skin and learning what they teach you.
Well, I will say it was a hard book to read, but once I started to read it, I couldn't put it down. So I wanted to look too, but I think this is the kind of stuff that's every parent's nightmare. And I agree with you. I think most parents whose children survive into adulthood just think they're lucky.
Yes, yes. Actually, you know, it's been interesting going around the country. Often people will come and say, why did you write such a sad book? But actually, I think there's a lot of funny bits in it, too. But I met someone who said just a really nice, just a lovely thing that kind of summed up, I think, also why I wrote it. He said it was a comfort to go through that grief. And, you know, it sort of took my breath away because it really expressed to me why I wrote the book.
Did this come from a particular incident that you knew about, you read about, you heard about?
When my son was two and going to a babysitter for about 12 hours a week, there was another little boy who was his age who drowned in the family swimming pool. And, you know, I didn't really know them, but it was horrifying and just so sad. And I felt, you know, that this was something that could happen to anyone. And I, you know, I could imagine just the guilt the parents must feel. They, you know, I'm sure they thought they turned their back for a few minutes and then the child was gone.
Well, this little girl that does drown and does die, I don't think I'd be giving too much away by saying that. The girls, these mothers are very good friends.
Yes.
And in certain ways, the mother of the child that drowns is able to mourn in a way that Alice can't.
Yes.
And the question is, what do you say to someone in that position who is responsible for another person's child, and that child dies? There's almost nothing worse to contemplate.
I know. I think that's, you know, also I certainly have had many times when the neighbor children are over. And, you know, I can think of several instances when I didn't know where they were, or they're in the barn and maybe they've gotten bitten by a rabid raccoon. I don't know, any number of things. And, you know, and yet you have to let them live. So that, too, has been my nightmare.
More from Jane Hamilton, author of A Map of the World, after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Jane Hamilton, author of A Map of the World. Now, you start the story out with an unspeakable tragedy that happens to Alice and to this little girl, and then you add on to that. I mean, not too many pages later, some policemen come to her at a school meeting and begin to question her about her relationship with a child at school. She's a school nurse. And more tragedy is heaped on her. Why did you want to do this to this poor character?
Well, actually, Most of the things that I've written, I've known the last line, and so the story or the book is like a journey to that last line. And when I started this book, I knew that I was, the beginning was the drowning, that was the kernel. And I knew that Alice got into this trouble because of it. But I didn't understand how she got out of her trouble or what she had to learn, and I actually wrote four distinct novels, all with different plots, trying to figure out how to get her free. All of them didn't go down deep in any way, and I really didn't understand what she had to learn. So it was in probably 89 or 90 that I read about a couple of cases where people were apparently unjustly convicted of abusing children. And it was horrifying, and I was really gripped with the idea of how easy it is to have your life taken from you and how you have no recourse and the system takes over. And particularly with children, there's really no way to get at the truth after years have passed. And so I thought, this is the perfect trouble for Alice. Mm. And I realized that she had to get in deeper before she came clear. And yet I resisted writing about it because it seems that every novel you open is about abuse.
Well, that's right. This is a very tricky issue to try to write about in a complex way.
Well, and I also, you know, I thought, how am I going to write about this without sounding like the Monday Night Movie? Mm-hmm. So I resisted taking it on, but after a while I thought, well, I felt duty bound to her to get her out of the trouble. And so I thought, I think this is the only way.
Were you interested in testing Alice then and taking her, sort of heaping as much suffering as you possibly could on one woman and see what she would do?
I don't think I thought about it in such a conscious way. So much happens on an intuitive level. People have asked me that, you know, why did you give her so much trouble? You know, I don't think it ever occurred to me that it was more than she could handle, and that I think I knew that her strengths would surface, and that she in a way, you know, she really, when the abuse situation arises, she feels that it's an opportunity to pay her pound of flesh, and in a way she's grateful for the trouble.
And the pound of flesh because of the guilt over the drowning. So a way of balancing that.
Right.
Do you identify with being in a situation, which certainly Alice is in, of being accused of something that you can't really defend yourself against?
Well, I was in a situation just with a neighbor where the little girls were doing something that I thought was fine and my neighbor was appalled by. And this was my best friend.
What was it?
It's in there. They were running around without their clothes on, jumping on the bed. And my neighbor said, "What is it about your sexed house?"
And that's a direct quote.
Yes,
I did use it.
And I was so shocked that here was somebody I thought we shared a sensibility. I thought nothing was wrong. I remember doing that as a kid. And she just didn't have that in her experience. And she actually is a therapist and deals with a lot of sexual abuse. And I sort of realized that she didn't have perspective on what was normal and healthy. But it really scared me. And it was just about the time that I was seeing these things. And I thought, my God, this could happen to me. And, you know, a few little misunderstandings.
What did you say to her?
I said, I really think that this is normal, that they're just exploring and we need to respect their privacy. And and then I called everybody that night that I'd grown up with and knew and said, "Did you take your clothes off when you were kids?" You know, I was really unsettled. And then I realized that she had probably lost perspective with her profession. And later we talked about it. I mean, we let a little time go by and we talked about it, and she's been very generous about it and read the book, and we've laughed about it, and she's been wonderful.
But did she keep her child away from your house?
For a little while. She said they couldn't play dress-up anymore because that entailed taking their clothes off.
Wow.
And that they had to put their tutus on over their clothes.
Let me shift gears if I can. Now, you do live in an apple orchard. Your husband is a, that was a little Freudian slip there, your husband is an apple farmer. I assume that makes you an apple farmer too?
I started out helping him full time, and then I had children, and we had children, and that sort of absolved me of some of my duties. And then when I could justify spending time writing What I'm trying to say is I don't help as much as I used to.
You feel guilty about it?
No, I feel guilty that I don't feel guilty. But I really enjoy, I enjoy picking apples, and there's a wonderful harvest fall feeling on a weekend when people are making their annual trek to buy apples. And it's quite wonderful. It's very intense. It's my husband, you know, I see him, I think he feels like a slave and a king in the same breath because he's his own boss, but he and his partner work like pack mules. They work very hard.
And is do you think the kind of rhythm of farm life, is that conducive to writing?
No. It's really full-time.
Because it never stops.
It never
right?
stops, mm-hmm. and it's very immediate. I used to, you know, sit up in my office and watch them all heaving and sweating, and the apples are there. You can't wait, but a story can wait. Mm-hmm. A story theoretically doesn't rot. You know, I feel very fortunate that I can help where I can, but that I also can do my other thing, as it were.
Do you feel confident, though, that a story can't rot? And I would think that,
no, a story rots. A story does.
That's
rot.
What I would think. And if you can't get something down on paper, then maybe you've lost it.
Right. I think there's an urgency to it every bit as much as the apple on the bough. But of course, it's not tangible. So for years it was hard just for myself to justify spending the time on it.
Do you think you're a good writer?
Do I think I'm a good writer? There's parts of this book that I can't look at because it makes me wince, and there's other places that I feel proud of and that I feel are finished. But I don't think that anything is ever really done. I could work on this book very happily for another year.
Jane Hamilton's latest novel is called A Map of the World. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about all things considered today. Noah, do you have any news for us?
Hi, Marty. We'll talk about the news 20 years ago when President Nixon resigned. Linda Wertheimer offers recollections of that time, and we'll hear from some of our listeners back then. Mary Kay Magstad reports on the history of animosity between Hutus and Tutsi in Rwanda. I'll talk with a fish and game officer in New Hampshire about a power plant there that's been collecting lobsters in the intake of seawater, some 200 lobsters a day, it said. It's a charge that employees have been taking home lots of lobsters.
Okay, Noah, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Songwriter and guitarist Robert Pete Williams died in 1980 without ever becoming a big-time legend of the blues. Recently, a good portion of his finest albums, along with much unreleased material, have come out on two CDs, I'm As Blue As a Man Can Be and When a Man Takes the Blues. Commentator Milo Miles says they belong on any representative blues collection.
I blew out as I can. Oh, yes, sir, it's a man. Oh, yes, sir, that blue is a man.
You would think Robert Pete Williams would have made more out of his life story. After all, Leadbelly is famous with people who never listen to the blues because they know he was convicted of murder and sang his way out of prison. The same story was true of Williams. In fact, it was the same prison, Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. It was there in 1959 that musicologist Dr. Harry Oster made Williams' first recordings. They became a sensation in the relatively intimate blues world of the time, and their reissue should cause even more excitement now. Many old-time white blues scholars made a big deal out of inventive playing styles and creative lyrics. They overlooked the fact that part of being a successful blues performer was fitting into a set body of work that would please an audience, knowing the top 40, as it were. Even so, there's always something to be said for originality, and Robert Pete Williams is among the most original blues men ever.
Louis! You're the sweetest gal I know.
is the sweetest gal I know. She maybe walked from Chicago. But you got the Mathico.
Williams would go for the standard blues structure of repeating first lines of verses, but that was about it. No 12 bars, no regular chord changes, and many times no precise rhythms except those set by his hypnotic voice and the elastic riffs he invented. He often improvised narratives on the spot, scans of his state of mind. Guitarist Henry Kaiser points out in his perceptive liner notes to I'm Blue as a Man Can Be that Williams' style has much in common with stringed instrument music from Africa, which may have been the basis of American rural blues guitar. Kaiser also notes that because Williams didn't record until 1959, he had little effect on the black blues tradition, but had far more influence on white players such as Ry Cooder and Captain Beefheart. And danged if he can't hear that in his work, too.
This a wild old lie. People have it all out long. This a wild old lie. Like they live it all alone.
Like many Delta blues players, Williams often sang of intense gloom and doom, perhaps eased momentarily by the comfort of religion. He's such a potent storyteller that he can make a chance encounter with a woman that never really resolves into anything sound like an epic meeting shot through with omens. He never considered himself a professional musician before his recording career began, and even after he was paroled in the early 60s, he did not do as well on the concert circuit as some other lesser performers who were discovered around that time. Williams is strange and takes some getting used to. He makes almost no gesture toward being entertaining.
Oh, Santa, you rock, you better find your hind play. Oh, Santa, you better rock, better find your hind play. Oh, Santa, you better rock, you better find your hind play. Oh, my Lord, what shall I do?
Williams made a number of albums after he got out, but none of them are quite as breathtaking or harrowing as his prison sessions. He reflected on his years in jail again and again. The power of Williams' art seems to have been unusually dependent on his mood, and those were volcanic indeed while he was behind bars. And yet, at his darkest, he suggests the penitentiary was just the formalizing of the conditions under which he had to exist in a racist, sinful world.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. He reviewed I'm as Blue as a Man Can Be and When a Man Takes the Blues by Robert Pete Williams on the Arhuli record label. Fresh Air senior producer this week is Fred Landerl, and our engineers are Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Richard Parker. Sue Spolin directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moskowain.
Been on the boat three times. Each time I was renowned.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, bringing together the fact and fiction of crime in America, writers and officials who deal with crime join each other in a panel discussion trying to make sense of crime and punishment. I'm Artie Moskowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.